You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Welcome to the latest podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. That's, of course, assuming that the Foundational Questions Institute is real.
You think FQXI might just be an illusion, Brendan? Or some kind of nightmare?
I just can't help wondering what really exists at the fundamental level. I mean, weird things happen on quantum scales. Particles can be in two places at the same time. Heisenberg told us that we can never know precisely where an electron is and where it's going at the same time. When we carry out quantum experiments, we can't even know for certain what the outcome will be.
Yeah, well, that's why we have the quantum wave function, Brendan. The wave function is a mathematical thingamajig that we plug into equations so that we can calculate the probability of getting a certain result in a quantum test.
But what is this thingamajig actually, deep down? Suppose I hypothetically put Puffy the cat in a box with some poison that may or may not be released if a radioactive atom does or does not decay. Wait, Puffy, come back. It's just a thought experiment.
Right, yes. This is the paradox of Schrodinger's cat, or Foster's cat. Before you open the box, the atom has, in some sense, both decayed and not decayed.
The poison has and has not been released.
And Puffy the cat is both alive and, well, you know...
Yes, so okay, the wave function helps me calculate what I'm likely to find when I open the box. But does that really mean that the cat is both alive and existentially challenged inside the box? Or is the cat simply either dead or alive, and I just don't know which because I can't see? Does the wave function represent our uncertainty about the true state of reality? Or does the wave function correspond to reality itself?
Physicists have been debating different interpretations of quantum mechanics for decades, but in February, quantum physicists Martin Ringbauer and Alessandro Fedrizzi of the University of Queensland in Brisbane, Australia, and their colleagues published an experiment in Nature Physics that they claim strengthens the view that, assuming a notion of objective reality exists, the wave function is real. I caught up with Ringbauer and Fedrizzi earlier via Skype, and they kindly chatted to me about their experiments and what exactly they mean, despite some rather turbulent weather conditions, as Fedrizzi explains.
Let me just say that we're at the northern New South Wales coast at the workshop, and we're getting hammered by a Category 5 cyclone that's just coming in from the Pacific. So I'm just saying this, so it might be that the connection cuts out, then you know that we'll need rescue.
Oh, okay, right. I'll call the international rescue for you if you do disappear.
Excellent.
Right. Oh my goodness, this is even more dramatic than your paper possibly, but...
yes.
But sure, let's start off. You know, you've written this very exciting paper in Nature Physics based on an experiment that you've carried out that, you know, looks at the reality of the wave function. You know, perhaps you can just tell us a little bit about, you know, why this is such an interesting topic and why you were interested in thinking about it.
I think everyone is interested in this question, really, and not just in science. I think all of us probably have at some point thought about, you know, what is it that is real? What is the universe made of, really? So at the quantum level, the wave function is really our best description of what happens, and it's the start of every calculation. And we have a pretty good idea how quantum systems evolve once you know what the wave function is. But the question really is, how does it connect to this reality that we're looking for? And so there's a number of opinions you can hold. So you can either think that there isn't any objective reality, so that, you know, every reality that we assign to a quantum state eventually after measurement is just subjective to whoever observed it. But there are also a large group of people who think that reality should be objective, so that, you know, independent of who measures it and how you measure it, it should give you the same reality in the end. And within that category of models, we can now decide what the wave function really represents.
So I guess, you know, the famous example, perhaps I should say, is the one of Schrodinger's cat. You know, you lock a cat in a box with some poison that will be released by a radioactive trigger mechanism. And when the box is shut and we don't know what's going on, that radioactive process may or may not have happened. Yep. The poison may or may not have been released, and the cat may be alive or it may be dead. And then we say this very sort of intriguing thing of, you know, before the box is open, the cat is both alive and dead at the same time. And so, you know, what does the wave function tell us? And then how would that, how might that relate to what's really out there?
Yeah. So as a cat person, I really struggle with. So the wave function really tells us that there is a superposition. It can be in a state of alive and dead at the same time. And the question is that, you know, if you believe in an objective reality, then a very popular explanation of what's going on with a cat is that the wave function, which describes the superposition of alive and dead, really just represents a lack of knowledge of what the cat's real state is at the moment. So, you know, the cat would be actually dead or actually alive. It's just we don't know what it is, and that's why we describe it as a superposition of alive and dead. And so as we open the box, we supposedly just reveal this objective reality, which was always there, and nothing strange is really happening. The other thing that could be happening is that the wave function directly corresponds to this underlying reality. And now that is a problem, because if the underlying reality is really alive plus dead, then we're really looking at a cat which is alive and dead at the same time. And so this is the viewpoint that our results sort of strengthen.
In 2012, theoretical physicists Matthew Pusey, Jonathan Barrett, and Terry Rudolph came up with a theorem, which has been dubbed the PBR theorem based on their initials, that appear to show that models that claim that the wave function represents our uncertainty about objective reality must be wrong. These models are called psi-epistemic, or knowledge models. But as Fedrizzi explains, their theorem had problems.
What kicked this off was this paper by PBR in 2012, where they tried to just write down a so-called no-go theorem, where they said, with this paper, we can essentially rule out all models in which the wave function just describes some limited knowledge. But that failed because there were a number of additional assumptions that they had to make. And there were a number of similar papers which also tried to write down no-go theorems, which also had additional assumptions. And so that's why people, and in particular some of our co-authors, so Cyril Brancyard and Eric Cavalcanti, and of course others, why they sort of switched tactics and moved to trying to just put some numerical bounds on these knowledge models by looking at how well they explained quantum state overlap.
The quantum state overlap that Fedrizzi alludes to describes an ambiguity that can occur in the lab when you try to measure the property of, for example, a photon using a single measurement, leaving you uncertain about that property. To help illustrate the idea of an overlap in an everyday context, Martin Ringbauer uses a simple example involving two sets of playing cards.
So a classical example of this would be take two decks of cards, where the one deck contains only aces and the other deck contains only red cards. Now, if you randomly draw a card and you happen to end up with the Ace of Hearts, then you cannot tell from which deck of cards it came from.
In their experiment, the team looked at the overlap between the states of polarized photons. When photons are polarized in completely different or orthogonal directions, such as vertical and horizontal, they can be distinguished and you will not see this kind of overlap. But if you prepare their polarizations in non-orthogonal directions, for instance, having some with a vertical polarization and some with a diagonal polarization, then you can end up with a similar situation such as was seen in the playing cards example, with an overlap when you carry out a single measurement. This overlap, Ringbauer explains, can make the two states indistinguishable by a single measurement.
Well, I mean, if you end up with the Ace of Hearts, then you can never tell where it came from, no matter how many measurements you make on that card. And that's the idea for why we should not be able to distinguish two non-orthogonal quantum states, because they overlap in a similar way as the decks of cards overlap. And every now and then, our preparation in the lab actually leads to the same objective reality. And then the two are exactly the same, so we cannot distinguish them.
Going back to the playing cards analogy, it's possible to calculate how often you should expect such an overlap to occur. If one deck contains 13 aces of each suit and the other contains red cards, then you'll get an overlap when you pick out any one of the 26 red aces from the ace pack. If when you test this, you find a greater level of ambiguity than this, then this uncertainty you observe cannot fully be explained by overlap alone, and the psi epistemic model fails. As Fedrizzi explains, his colleagues were similarly able to calculate how much overlap various psi epistemic models can explain in the case of photons. And this could be put to test in the lab.
And then they came up with some measures for what this overlap should be in the quantum world and what this measure should be in the classical overlap world, if you so want, in these epistemic models. And then they just tried to compare these two numbers, and they found that they don't agree with each other. And that's essentially what they then designed an experimental test for, and that's the test that we carried out. The overlap of these epistemic states could either fully explain why states are not distinguishable, or it can, for example, not explain it at all, or it can explain it a little bit. So there is a continuous range of how much this overlap could essentially explain. What these guys came up with is really an experimental test where you can just essentially measure where this boundary lies.
In their experiment, the team looked at a system of photons that had some extra properties beyond polarization and carried out measurements that allowed them to work out the amount of overlap in their system and compare this with the predictions of psi epistemic models. Here's Ringbauer.
From all these measurements, we then calculate some probabilities, and that gives us an estimate of how much overlap can be in a knowledge model for those states that we chose. So we compare this to the quantum overlap of those states that we can just calculate from standard quantum mechanics, and then we calculate the ratio. And whenever that ratio is below 1, we show that the knowledge interpretation cannot explain everything. And the further down we can get this ratio, the less can be explained.
Okay, so now you've carried out your experiment and you're trying to kind of push this boundary to see where exactly it lies. So what did you find?
And now in the experiment, we found a bound of 0.7 approximately. So we are fairly certain that maximally subsystemic models are not possible. And as we improve our experiment, we want to push this bound further down and eventually get close to zero.
We're talking here, you're sort of saying, well, we've ruled out this kind of maximally psi epistemic model.
Yeah, that's right.
But what's this kind of grey area in between where you say that, you know, you could have a psi epistemic model that's perhaps less maximal, that's non-maximal?
On the one end, we have the maximally psi epistemic interpretations that explain all of that indistinguishability in terms of overlapping epistemic states. On the other hand, we have psi-ontic models, which we call them, which means that the wave function is actually in direct correspondence with the reality of our quantum system. And in that case, there is absolutely no overlap. So from knowing the state of reality, you automatically know the wave function as well. And in those models, you need some other explanation. And that basically means that measurements can only give us limited information.
Okay, so going back to your kind of analogy with the playing cards, if it's 100% maximal psi epistemic model, then you'll say that the ambiguity comes because, you know, you could have a card which is the ace of hearts and it simply could have come from either bag and you can't tell which. But as we go to non-maximal models, then you would say, well, part of it is maybe the card could have come from one bag or another bag, but part of it is also that I don't have my glasses on, so I can't see very well what it is that I'm looking at. And so that also brings in some ambiguity, and that's a limit on my knowledge. Is it something like that? So you have to kind of bring in different explanations to try and explain the same level of confusion.
Yeah, it's something along those lines. So in a maximally psi epistemic model, you could say you have the correct number of cards in both decks so that you can explain the indistinguishability of those quantum states that quantum mechanics tells you. And as you go to a psi-ontic model, basically the number of overlapping cards decreases. And eventually you have two decks that have no overlap anymore. And yeah, you have to take your glasses off so that you can still explain why you cannot distinguish those states.
So now maximally psi epistemic models have been ruled out. I asked Ringbauer, what's left?
We rule out an important class of interpretations of quantum mechanics, and they are interesting because they would have allowed for very intuitive explanations for all those weird features of quantum mechanics. But there are still some interpretations that are available, and so, for example, you could either accept that the wave function is now actually real and corresponds to its objective reality, or you say there is no objective reality, or you can go even further and say there is not even a wave function. We don't even need the wave function. Just to point to one of your recent podcasts about Howard Wiseman explained a new interpretation where they just completely get rid of the wave function. So there are still some approaches out there, and we'll have to see how our experimental capabilities progress, and maybe we can rule out some more and actually narrow it down to a class of interpretations that are still possible.
But it does seem very, very exciting, I think. Also, just, you know, as you sort of say, as you're putting this emphasis on experiment, that for so long we've been thinking about these just in theoretical terms, and to be able to really do an experiment now, that's quite an incredible achievement.
Oh, it's very exciting. It's really the first experiment that can completely rule out one class of those interpretations.
Excellent, excellent. And should I ask you, do you have a favorite interpretation?
Yeah, it definitely gave us something to think about. I myself am not 100% decided. Certainly not psi-epistemic anymore.
This is Alessandro again. So when we give talks on this topic, we often ask for a show of hands and for the audience to decide what they actually think is their favorite interpretation. And Martin only just did this 2 days ago at our workshop here. Unfortunately, the largest show of hands is always for undecided. So, you know, 80% of the audience don't have any opinion at all, and apparently they're just in the shut up and calculate camp. For me personally, as an experimentalist, I sometimes tend to move with whatever my current experiment tells me. So at the moment, I certainly don't believe anymore in this sort of Einsteinian view of the world of these, maximal knowledge models. But I also struggle to fully accept the psiontic models because, you know, they contain some of my least favorite interpretations like Bohmian mechanics and many worlds. So we'll see what the future holds, I guess. I think what we really need and what would be really very exciting would be some kind of test that distinguishes between is there a reality or is there no reality. So that would be the next exciting frontier, I think, for also for foundational physics.
Thank you to Alessandro Fedrizzi and Martin Ringbauer for explaining their experiment to Zia. If you visit the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find links to their Nature Physics paper and news articles about their work. We're also linking to an interview with quantum physicist Ian Durham from 2012, in which he explains the theoretical work by FQXI member Jonathan Barrett, along with Matthew Pusey and Terry Rudolph, that also examined the reality of the wave function. And you can listen to our interview with Howard Wiseman about the possibility that many interacting classical worlds exist.
And if, like these researchers, you enjoy questioning the foundations, then you'll be pleased to learn that FQXI has released a compilation of essays from our 2012 contest asking you which of our fundamental physical assumptions is wrong. The volume, published by Springer, collects together updated and slightly more technical versions of our winning essays.
The compilation of modified essays from our 2013 It From Bit or Bit From It contest is also on sale now. You'll find links to those on our site too. I want to say that rereading the essays now, away from the pressure of the contest, I appreciate even more how good those essays were.
Yeah, they really are. They're worth another look if you've seen them already, and if you haven't, then, you know, now's your chance.